Welcome to Philosophy and Faith, where our goal is to help you navigate your intellectual and spiritual journey, especially in regards to topics like God, faith and doubt, meaning and purpose, and more. I'm Nathan Beasley.
And I'm Daniel Jepson. And together we discuss the big questions that humans have wrestled with for thousands of years.
We're glad you can join us. Well, hello again. Welcome back, Dr. Justin Gash. We are excited to have you back on. We're going to explore a little bit about the moral argument, because you mentioned in the last episode at the end of it that that's the argument from William Lane Craig's book, Reasonable Faith, that has most resonated with you. So I was wondering if you could walk us through what that is off the bat. We can kind of discuss it, and then maybe toward the end, we can hear kind of more your experience of how you're interacting with that and why you find it helpful and compelling.
Sure, absolutely. So the moral argument consists of two premises and a conclusion. The first premise is that if there is no God, objective moral values and duties don't exist. Another way to phrase that I think sometimes is helpful is objective moral values and duties exist only if God exists. The second premise is that objective moral values and duties do exist, and therefore God exists.
All right. So a nice cogent argument.
Mm-hmm.
A only if B. A exists, therefore B exists.
That's exactly right.
Wait. The question there is, what if there are no objective morals and duties, right?
So that's what the second premise has to address, is that those objective moral values and duties do in fact exist. Premise one is looking more at who or what could lay such obligations upon us. And what I find fascinating about both the philosophical naturalism, which would be a prominent worldview for atheists and Western theists, is that everyone seems to be on board with that premise. There are exceptions, and I'm happy to discuss that if you would like. But
So you're saying premise two, that objective moral standards and obligations exist. You say most people would concede that?
No, I'm referring to the first one.
I see. I'm sorry. Premise one.
The premise one, that objective moral values and duties exist only if God exists.
Okay.
The primary critique levied by an atheist worldview or a philosophical naturalist worldview would be against the reality of there being objective moral values and duties. Most of the prominent atheists would suggest that the ones that I've read would in fact say that, yeah, if there are objective moral values and duties, then who or what would lay this upon us? It would be God.
Okay. I see. So sounds like the key word there is objective.
Objective is a key word, yes.
Can you help us describe the difference between objectivity or objective morals and subjective morals?
Yeah. So subjective morals certainly exist. And subjective morals are the set of morals that are dependent upon the subject doing the analysis. So for example, I have a moral code. That would be my subjective morality. It's far from clear that my subjective morality is the objective morality I'm aiming for, but we all have a subjective morality. And subjective morality shift over time. For example, it would probably be a good assumption to make that we, the faculty of Franklin College, hope that the ethical understanding of our students improves after 4 years of study, as opposed to degenerating. I need to be careful because the fact that you can even improve implies that there's a direction we're going, right?
Okay.
But the point is that we each have our own subjective morality, and certainly it changes.
So that's like, I have a moral code, you have a moral code, ours are different.
Mm-hmm.
Can we say that one is necessarily better or worse than the other? Maybe that's same kind of thing, comparison here, but they just can be different.
They can be different, yes.
Objective would mean that there is one code, it is the code.
Yeah, objective moral values and duties are independent of the subject that is assessing them. So we might say, historically speaking, that there have been cultures in the world that thought, thinking of something that we would consider abominable today, pillaging communities to take their resources.
Or how about the Spartans who exposed babies?
Yes.
In the sense of exposing them to the elements to die.
That's, yes.
That's right up there for me. I can't imagine that.
Yeah. It's also right up there for me, because for those of you who can't see me on the podcast, which will be all of you, I am a disability. And so I'm quite certain in Sparta, they would have just thrown me in the pit. Yay for 20th century America.
I had thought of that, Justin.
But that's a great one, right? I mean, so their subjective view was that it was okay to do that.
There was no ethical qualm.
There was no ethical qualm about that. Our subjective view in modern day America is that there's absolutely something wrong. The question is there an objective reason to think that that is actually wrong? That is, it's not just because we decide that we don't like it anymore, but whether it is actually morally objectionable to expose babies.
Mm-hmm. So is there a transcendent objective moral code that's not just based on the socio-political structures of a given community in time?
Correct.
And or an individual.
Or an individual.
Okay. That's right. And you just hinted at why most philosophical naturalists, again, I want to say most, that's most that I'm familiar with. It's definitely not all, and I can provide examples. But many would subscribe to this claim, because if it's not a transcendent moral source that's laying these duties upon us, what would be the source? And really the most popular alternative would be a version of Platonism, which I cannot speak well enough about to be speaking to it on this podcast, but is not terribly popular in terms of moral and ethical obligation, I don't think.
Can I pass this question to Daniel then?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know if
no, that's okay.
Perhaps Pastor Dan has a better way of, I may not have been doing a very good job of walking through the moral argument.
No, I think
so
it's, I think it's been really good and helpful so far and clear. I think, so the question is, if objective morals aren't transcendent by somebody or some person, something that instills them, is there another place where they could be found? What do you think, Daniel?
I think it's tricky. I think any answer that philosophers have given have not proven satisfactory to many other philosophers. So you gave Plato as an example. Kant also believed in absolute moral duties in a sense. But the ground that both of them gave were based upon their own speculative metaphysics. And unless you buy into that, which most people don't, then you have no ground for that.
So there can be objections to premise one. Folks like Plato and Kant have given them, but they aren't really widely accepted, maybe?
I don't think for most people they're viable options.
Okay.
I mean, again, your mileage may vary, but I don't know anybody who would subscribe to Plato's theory of forms today as he put it forth and then view that as a basis for ethical duties or an objective morality.
Okay. Thanks. So back to objective and subjective. Other thoughts on those to help us understand?
Yeah, one thing that might be helpful for later and could also be an illustration now would be considering scientific claims that we would view as objective. So consider the eclipse, because we just had one. All right. It's absolutely true that some cultures have viewed the eclipse as a harbinger of doom or given its special metaphysical meaning. Mm-hmm. But objectively, we know that that is not the case. From a scientific point of view, it's the moon passing in front of us and the sun. That's what it is. So they may have had a subjective view. And you can still say our view is subjective, but I think most of us would say that that's an objective view. Let's put it this way. if that isn't sufficient to be objective, I don't know a context that exists where we could use the word objective in a meaningful way. At some point, we have sufficient evidence to suggest that regardless of what your views are, this is reality. And so in science, we would say that it's objectively true that the moon passes in front of the sun. And even though historically different cultures viewed that differently, or may have anthropomorphized the sun and the moon, it's still actually the case that in their time, the moon was just passing in front of the sun.
Yeah.
I want to clarify here. So you're not saying that scientific arguments and moral judgments are equal, but you're illustrating the difference between objectivity and subjectivity for both of these areas.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct.
So the premise there is that objective morals and duties exist only if God exists. So what's the connection between objective morals and duties and God's existence?
That's an interesting question, and I guess I would think about who or what the candidates would be. For us to have objective moral values, meaning that there are things that are objectively good and objectively evil, and objective moral duties, meaning there's things that we ought to do and things that we ought not to do, there has to be something or somebody laying those requirements on us. What candidates are there? Naturalism offers no sources for objective moral values and duties. It is amoral by its very construct.
Not immoral.
Not immoral, amoral. So you've never been in a science class where they've talked about the generosity molecule and how it operates, and we take in the generosity molecule and now we are obligated to be generous.
But I have heard of the happiness hormone of dopamine.
Indeed.
Happiness isn't a moral virtue, though.
So there can be physiological effects that can help, is it not?
I don't think so. But anyway, I think the way I've heard this summarized is that you cannot get ought from is.
Yes, that would be a fair summary.
From the bare fact that the universe exists doesn't give you any basis for saying what should then happen within this universe.
That's correct.
So the naturalistic perspective says we're here, this happened, but it doesn't really provide a good argument for the existence of objective morals. So most naturalists, their qualm wouldn't be with premise one, it'd be with premise two. They'd say, well, we don't believe that objective morals and duties actually exist. Is that right?
For most, that would be my take, yes.
Well, let's talk about premise two then, because you said this is where most of the intellectual action is. So why is that true? And what are the arguments against it?
I think the best argument that it exists, and certainly the argument that William Lane Craig would put his weight behind, is that we have a rational basis for experiencing the world around us and trusting the experiences that we have. And that notions of injustice and immorality or goodness are inherent, that we can observe what's right and good in the same way we can observe that we are speaking into microphones right now. Objections that might fall under the same objections if someone said, well, how do we know we're speaking into a microphone right now? Maybe it's an illusion. Maybe everything is organizing itself in a way around us to delude ourselves. So I think natural experience for most folks is that they do see moral values and moral duties in the world around them. For example, I'm going to give an example that's rough and not highly contextual just to make the point. We would say that child abuse is wrong. Or at least I claim that. I claim that child abuse is actually wrong. I appreciate that other people and other cultures may not have always agreed with that, and that sexual abuse may have taken place, or that physical abuse may have taken place. But they were wrong in the exact same sense that they were wrong about the moon chasing down the sun during the eclipse, that actually child abuse, physical, sexual, emotional, is wrong. To negate the premise that objective moral values and duties do exist, to negate that, you're saying there are no objective moral values or duties. So the counterclaim is that there are no objective moral values and duties anywhere at all. And so to me, that would be my affirmative argument for the case that objective moral values and duties do exist. In our reality, we experience that they do in fact exist.
And that seems to be the universal reaction that people have, right? When I say child abuse is wrong, I'm not just saying I don't like it. I'm not just saying, well, it's wrong for us in the American culture, but say in China or Nigeria, it'd be fine. I'm making an objective statement that this is fundamentally wrong. And we all do that. We all criticize other people's choices and decisions, and often our own, hopefully, on the basis that some things are simply right and simply wrong, not that they're a human preference.
So that speaks to the objectivity of these claims. When you say that this is wrong and it's always wrong, it doesn't matter if it's been prosecuted in other times and cultures. It doesn't matter because it's objectively wrong. Like, it's not a product of us being here in this time and place.
Yeah, I think this is very important for us understanding history and putting things where they properly ought to go. So in thinking about World War II and the Holocaust, to say that it's something is objectively wrong is to say that even if the Nazis had won and they'd taken over the world and they had brainwashed everyone through an education program, that it was good and right to murder Jewish people, eradicate them, it still wouldn't actually be right. It's actually wrong. This is important when we analyze history, because I think about America's own history with slavery. If the argument is that there are no objective moral values and duties, then when I say slavery is wrong, I'm really just stating an opinion. And I mean, how much more important is my opinion than a slave owner's opinion?
Right. And who is to adjudicate between those two opinions?
And is it majority rules that it was right when it was happening because it was legal? That seems like some dangerous thinking.
Yeah, it seems like it's dangerous thinking. And whatever term, however we would define morals, it doesn't seem like that's a natural definition for what we mean when we're talking about morality at all. Because we can come up with a legion of counterexamples where people or cultures, including modern-day American culture, are behaving in ways that, upon review, probably aren't good, even though they are popular or were popular. The point being here that when we have these objective moral values and duties, we're distinguishing them from the subjective whims of the individual or a society. And we're saying that they're set apart. And I think that's important for analyzing history appropriately.
So Daniel, can you help us understand then, if we've got something called objective morality, how does the subjective morality relate to that? Because I think that there are certain things, like our moral code here is different than the moral code of Nazi Germany. Are they both equally valid, or what's the interplay between the subjective and the objective?
Yeah, fair question. And I'd love to get Justin's take on this too, because he might have a more informed or thoughtful take. But for me, I would say we all have a subjective morality, like Justin just mentioned. We may not articulate it, but the very fact that we make moral choices and very often make consistent types of moral choices indicates that we have a subjective morality. Now, that's not wrong. We should have that subjective morality. But the question is not whether that's right or wrong, but whether there is some standard that this should ultimately conform to or not. If it's simply subjective in the sense that no one is able to criticize it, there is no one who could adjudicate whether mine is better than someone else's, even if they have opposite values, That's the deeper question. I'm not sure if that's what you're asking or not. Okay. Justin, did you have a take on that?
I concur with your take. And I think...
Always a good idea.
Yeah, that's what, that's why I do it. It's part of my moral, subjective moral code, Daniel. I agree. And I think the question is, does our subjective moral codes, is it working to approximate an actual true objective morality?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when people say, look at all the progress we've made, and they're talking about ethics, what they're saying isn't that we're perfect. It's saying that we are imperfect, but we're aiming somewhere. We have a target in mind. If there's no target in mind, there's no measurable way of discerning right or wrong. It's just different moral views in a space with no direction.
Yeah. I'm also reminded of the fact that in France, there is within a vault an iron rod that's exactly 1 meter long. And they've taken various pains to make sure that it is the standard. So if Justin and I say we're both working on a house or working on a building together, and I have my idea of what a meter should be, and we're making all these measurements and buying all this material, putting things together based on that, and he has a different one, well, the question is there a standard that we can both appeal to see, okay, which one of us is actually right? And let me pick up on that. One question I think you can ask someone who would label themselves a progressive is, what are we to progress towards? What is the end goal? Is there some final state of what society should look like that is the standard for whether we're progressing there or regressing, that is a standard for motivating our actions towards that? And then related to that, okay, why that goal instead of another? My point being that when we have this idea of progress, it implies that there is this universal state that we should be working towards, which has universal objective moral goodness towards it, in it, towards it or in it. So anyway, that's my 2 cents.
Yeah, and if you want that for other cultures or communities as well, that seems to hint at some sort of objectivity.
Right.
So if we think that slavery is bad, not just in this culture, but also in the Caribbean and in Latin America or other places, that seems to me that it's pointing toward, okay, it's not just because I was born into this place and assumed these cultural values. It's that, no, it actually transcends cultural values.
Right. We want this not just because it's our personal opinion that, and a desire for ourselves, but because we view it as an objectively better state of society.
So it seems to me that, well, I like what you said at the beginning, that subjective morals are true. It's not that there are no subjective morals. That this argument argues about objective morals. Everybody has their own thoughts on what's right and what's wrong in a given situation. But to be moral subjectivists, we really can't have any grounds for trying to impose that on somebody else, can we? I mean, it's just, this is right for me. That's moral relativism, which on a society level in a global economy is going to just be dangerous.
I would agree. And to use your language from the podcast, I think it's also just an unlivable. I think that's an unlivable philosophy that folks who purport to believe that don't actually live out. Because there are right and wrong things, and we behave, as Dan mentioned, as if there are really wrong things to do and really right things to do all the time.
It just seems to me that if I'm ever upset that you did something wrong against me, say you cut me off in traffic, I mean, well, that's wrong for me, but it might not be wrong for you, which really means that I have no valid reason to even be upset with you. Isn't that?
Well, there's no basis. There's just no basis to make a moral judgment.
Other than it's just, well, this is what the law is, yeah. So.
You can have descriptive statements like, I felt angry. But the point raised previously, that doesn't take an is to an ought, right? You are angry does not mean that you ought to be angry, or that they ought to have done something differently. It's just a statement of emotion. Perhaps I might add what I think is the biggest attack against that premise, because we are all, well, we all believe in God. So we are We front loaded the argument. And for us, there is absolutely an objective moral standard, and that standard is God. But let's say that we were arguing from an apologetic point of view, and we want God to be on the back end of the argument as a result of the syllogism, right? So I would say the most prominent rebuttal on the grounds of philosophical naturalism would be that there is, and I'm paraphrasing, I forgot his name, evolutionary biologist.
Dawkins.
Thank you. Yeah. To paraphrase Richard Dawkins, that there is at base no good, no evil, no right, no wrong, just cold, pitiless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. That is all. We're all here through unguided natural selection and evolution. There is no grand design. Everything we perceive as moral values and duties is really just socio-biological, perhaps psychological evolution at play. And so we can't trust that any of our perceptions have any real value. They're just accidents. I think that would be the most prominent counterargument to the moral argument. As one might imagine, I can review the rebuttals to that attack. But
go for it.
Well, I really like the way William Lane Craig outlines this, because he makes, I'm going to take a little bit of a diversion here, but I want to make it clear. When you say that somebody's wrong, or that you do not subscribe to a particular belief, there are two ways you can mean that. First is that you just outright don't think the belief is correct. So you can just say, no, I think you're wrong. But the second way you could deny belief in something is to say, I don't have sufficient cause to believe in it. So you're not claiming it's wrong, but I need reason to believe in this, to be right. I need what philosophers call warrant. So the first way you can take that critique, that we are all products of socio-biological evolution, would be an attack on the truth of the statement, objective moral values and duties do exist. But that would be an example of the genetic fallacy, which would be to blame the source, to look at the source of our understanding and then declare the claim false. Even if socio-biological evolution is the source of our moral understanding, that doesn't actually demonstrate that objective moral values and duties don't exist. That's just a quibble with the source from which we get that knowledge from. What I think is more likely is the second attack, which is to say, because of socio-biological evolution, all of our thoughts and our brains are the result of accidental, unguided processes. And therefore, we can't trust our moral understanding, because on what basis would we? I think I've heard both of you mention before, Steven Pinker had a book that he released in the 90s.
How the Mind Works.
How the Mind Works. Thank you. And I think the quote is that our brains are organs that have developed through biological evolution. They are not tunnels to truth.
We are organisms, not angels. We have been shaped by natural selection alone to solve life and death problems, not to commune with correctness or answer any question that can be answered.
That. That's exactly what I was going to say if I was as informed and well-versed as Daniel.
For some reason, that's always stuck with me because it seems so self-contradictory. He's making the whole point that our minds can't make true statements about anything, maybe except for immediate sense perception. But that statement itself is that kind of claim that he's just undermining. So
anyway. He's saying our minds aren't made to work like that. With his own mind, yes. It wasn't made to work like that.
Exactly.
That is correct. And
that's interesting.
And I think that is the main rebuttal to that, that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. What you can't say is not intellectually consistent to say, well, our minds have developed through socio-biological evolution, which is unguided. Therefore, we can't trust the perceptions about objective morality. On those grounds, you can't trust the perceptions on anything.
Including the statement that our minds are developed by natural selection alone.
That's right. So it is self-defeating. But I'm going to tack on one more thing here, and I apologize if I'm taking up too much time.
Okay.
this is a newer thought that I've had recently, and so I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. But I mentioned earlier about how I don't think it's actually livable to believe that there are no objective moral values or duties. And I wanted to use How the Mind Works, Steven Pinker's text, as an illustration. We just covered how the statement that he makes that Dan quoted is self-defeating. But you also have to ask the question, why would someone who believes that write a nonfiction book? Telling
us the truth about how our minds work based upon faulty mind putting that forth, is that what you mean?
Yes, and then trusting that the people who are reading the book will gain something from it. Presumably, what they're gaining is truth, I would think. My point being is that the best explanation, I think, and I'm not as bright as Steven Pinker, and I'm picking on him, and I don't intend it in any kind of mean-spirited way, but I think the best explanation for that is to say that isn't actually what he believes. He can state it, but his whole life is one giant counterexample to the statement. He actually is a professor, and he does believe he can transmit truth. His entire vocation is spent transmitting truth. The fact that it's in a book means he thinks that he can transmit truth to people and that they can read it and incorporate it, and presumably that it has some sort of impact. I'm a little far afield here, but I think that is a direct analogy to what it means to not believe in any objective moral values and duties. I think people can state that, but in the end, they're going to walk away from the discussion table when they just said that, and they're going to live their entire life as if there are moral values and duties that they expect to be upheld, and that they will find it unreasonable if people are not doing it, if they're not doing what they say and they're dishonest, or they steal, or if they hurt others without proper cause. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very much so. So we got to wrap up here pretty soon. But at the beginning, you said this was the argument that you found most helpful, or at least resonated with you the most. Why?
I think it's the most personal of the apologetics arguments. And ultimately, it's about connecting with God. The other arguments are very good. Certainly from the Kalam cosmological argument, you can infer a creator. And you can infer a personal choice. Same with the teleological argument. You say there's a designer, would be to say that there is a personal agent making choices. But the moral argument is not only about God's objective standards for what ought to be done, it's about my ability to meet those standards. And in the case of Christianity, the realization that I objectively fail to meet those objective standards and am in desperate need of salvation through Jesus' redeeming sacrifice. It's also a growth mindset opportunity. Like, I have somewhere to go. Every day, I can look at my life and I can say, I can ask, did I meet the goal? And again, inevitably, the question is, I didn't. But that's not really the point in asking the question. The question is, where didn't I meet the goal? And how do I do it better the next time? And so there's this aspirational component to it. I don't know. What are your thoughts about the moral argument? Do you find it compelling?
I do. I think anyone can choose to deny the second premise, especially if they want to. But as you said, to do that with a consistency and livability, I think most people, when they sit down and think about it, like, yeah, I can't go there. I can't deny that some things are objectively right and wrong. And I think that's a good clue. It's a good sign. It's not a proof like a algebraic proof or something like that, but it's a good sign. So that's my take. What do you think, Nathan?
I think it's good not only because it points to God's existence, but it points to the character of God, and it points to how we see God as good. Like, freedom is good. That's because that attribute actually originated in God, who says he created us in his image. And so we actually inherit that attribute. Same thing with generosity or kindness or love or grace or peace. These are things that we look at and we think, okay, those are good. I want to experience those and to see that those are grounded in God. It's really meaningful. Because as you mentioned, kind of waking up each day and looking at how you lived up to that standard, you know, some people can take that and feel OCD about it or something. And I think that that's not the best response to that. I think the response to what you said is implicit there is, as I align my life to that objective moral standard, which is the character of God, my life actually takes on a better quality for me and the people around me. And that's a good thing. And that's the place I want to be. And I don't think people really argue with that. You know, I want to be a good person because I just feel like that's the right way and that's better for the people around me. Does that point to the existence of God? And I think the moral argument shows that it does.
Thank you very much, Justin. Did you have anything else you want to talk about?
No, I just wanted to thank you all for the opportunity to be on the podcast. And
you'll get our bill.
Darn it! I thought I was getting paid for this.
No. We do things backwards too.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been great.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, click follow or subscribe depending on your platform. Check the notification bell so you're up to date with new episodes and leave us a review. Until next time.